Good evening, everyone. This is when you're going to be watching it. It's the afternoon right now, but we have a very, very exciting podcast that starts today. I'm joined by the one and only Gary Phillips of the New York Daily News for our first episode of the Bronx Beat. This will be a twice a week podcast when we can. Obviously, the craziness of the regular season and Gary's adventures during the regular season will potentially affect some of that, but we'll generally try to stick to that schedule. This is a podcast that I'm very, very excited to start. I'm just so thrilled about this. And Gary, I'm going to let you take it away and kind of introduce yourself and talk about, you know, why you wanted to do this, what your goals are with this podcast. But it is an absolute pleasure to be able to say, Gary, take it away, man.
Well, I'm also extremely excited to be doing this. Have thought about starting a podcast since I've been on the Yankees beat. This is going to be my fourth season. I'm not as well-versed in the technical side and the editing side, so I'm really excited to partner with Ryan, who knows his stuff extremely well, and the Fireside Network, who, you know, provide all that infrastructure. For those of you that don't know, I am the beat writer at the New York Daily News. Like I said, this is going to be my fourth season. Spring training is right around the corner, and I'm really looking forward to the grind and also making this podcast part of it.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important parts of what we're going to be able to provide here is your perspective as a beat writer. And we're going to have a conversation about, you know, the differences being a beat writer versus kind of what is traditionally here on Fireside Yankees, the difference in perspectives, the difference in what that day-to-day looks like, not just from a, all right, how can you break down the Yankees, but what goes into these stories, your articles, your work on the New York Daily News. We'll be highlighting your top stories. And for you guys at home listening to this, we're going to be breaking down these stories because they're obviously relevant to the Yankees, but because the process of how they come together, I find fascinating. I think you guys at home will find fascinating. I'm really excited. This is an exciting day, I think. And Gary, I kind of want the audience to get to know you a little more in the sense of what, When we talk about what the Bronx Beat is about and what you're going to be able to provide to those at home that you just can't get in a lot of podcasts, not just Yankees really, but sports in general, what do you think they're getting that they wouldn't normally get?
I think, like you said, there's going to be that perspective of what it's like to be on a beat. So whether that is talking about things that, you know, fans might not necessarily see on camera or during a game, you know, the way the clubhouse works, the way the Yankees, you know, for better or worse, approach certain things, whether it be from, you know, an on-the-field standpoint, a PR standpoint, whatever it may be. I look forward to talking about those things. Ryan kind of mentioned it, but I'm really looking forward also to talking about, like, how some of my stories come together. You know, I really like focusing on feature stories. One thing I always say is, you know, the less it has to do with the game on the field, the more interested I am in writing about it. So I look forward to kind of explaining how I pick my topics, how I pick my stories, how they come together, how players and coaches and front office executives come to participate in those stories. And then also just talking a little bit, you know, more broadly about the industry as it pertains to baseball. I think there is a large market for sports media content. Sometimes that, you know, mystifies me a little bit as somebody who's in it, but I know that market exists. So figure you combine that with the New York Yankees, one of the most popular sports teams in the world, and there's going to be a little crossover audience. So I'm looking forward to talking about all of that. Hopefully we can get some guests on as well in the coming, you know, days, weeks, you know, however long this goes on for. And then, of course, also we're just going to be talking about what's happening with the New York Yankees.
Yeah, and again, when it comes to kind of the structure of this, it'll keep evolving. So there's a lot of stuff that we're going to be doing early on that might change in the future, whether it's the way we do our mailbags or, you know, the timing and like certain segments, when they are, when they're not. We are in the first, this is the first episode. This is the pilot in a sense. So there's a lot that we'll figure out very quickly about what works, what we feel works best. And this is also going to be very catered towards talking about like kind of how I run things, where I talk about what I want to talk about. We're going to like, we're not going to be trying to force conversations about Anthony Volpe every week because that's what everyone's talking about. Like, that's just not what this is going to be. So I'm really excited. I think it's going to be a really good, authentic baseball talk with obviously a focus on the Yankees and the beat writing side of things. Now, the first thing I wanted to talk to you about, Gary, was storylines. I mean, spring training is right around the corner. We are, I think at this point, a little under 2 weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting. I think it's right after the Super Bowl. We're not, I mean, you're going to be heading to Tampa. You're going to be going down there to George M. Steinbrenner Field and the surrounding facilities. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that preparation process looks like?
Yeah, so every year I try to go into spring training with a master list of every single player that's going to be in camp. And I try to have at least one story idea, if not just a note, a bullet point on each guy. So whether that is Aaron Judge or a top prospect or a non-roster invitee, I'm trying to have something on everybody. Doesn't mean I'm always going to get to it. Doesn't mean I'm going to get to it in the spring necessarily. You know, it might be something that I have for much later on in the year, something I think about, work through as the year goes on. But I try to have something on everybody. I'm a little bit behind, running against a little bit of a time crunch. Been further ahead on that list in past years at this point, but I'm also still waiting on the Yankees to release their NRI list, which, you know, is always fun for me because I like writing about those guys. I come from the mindset of everybody's got a story to tell. There's also so much time in spring training. Usually the big news, the big storylines happen right at the beginning and right at the end, so you got to fill those in-between days with something. So that's part of my prep. I still have to pack. Got a few interviews that I want to get done and some material that I want to go into spring training with. You know, this way I can just hit the ground running.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to the spring training, a lot of the intrigue around the NRIs and some of the bubble guys on the roster is because, especially with this year's group, there is a little more continuity, which we'll get to in a bit. So there isn't as many, like, who's the left fielder? Who's the third baseman? Who's the shortstop? Who's the second baseman? It's more like, hey, who's the eighth reliever on this roster? Who's the seventh starter on the roster? Which I will get into, and I think it's a very fascinating conversation. But what are some of those storylines that you've got kind of lined up and things you're going to be keeping an eye on in camp?
Yeah, so lately, I think every Yankee fan knows this whole run it back idea has been a central storyline for the team's offseason, and it will be going into spring training, barring any significant move in the next week or so. I think there is a debate to be had over the merits of running back a similar roster. I think the framing that Brian Cashman offered recently that it's not a similar roster, I don't think that's very genuine. I think the framing there was disingenuous. Now, if you want to talk about the merits of that, absolutely. Like, I get both sides of that debate. So that's one thing that we're going to have an eye on. I'm sure it'll come up with an Aaron Boone's first media availability, even though it's something he's talked about as well. I'm going to be watching the bullpen because I have serious questions about that group. I'm going to be keeping an eye on starting pitching health because the Yankees are already going to have three starters on the IL on opening day, and that's before you get through spring training and you get through the early parts of the season when there always seems to be some sort of rotation injury. I'm going to be looking at some of the young pitchers that the Yankees got. I'm going to be looking at NRIs, like I said, like guys at the back end of the 40-man roster who can compete for a roster spot, especially in that bullpen. There's a whole bunch of guys there that are going to be competing for spots. I'm going to be keeping an eye on guys who get increased opportunities with a lot of Yankees away for the World Baseball Classic. And then more of a league-wide story, I'm going to be keeping an eye on labor relations, comments about that, and impending possible lockout after this season with the CBA expiring. So those are all things I'll be kind of keeping track of, writing about, maybe not writing about, and kind of just stockpiling material and quotes and things of that nature. So yeah, spring training's an exciting time. For those that don't know, it's probably the best time for reporters. Guys are more accessible. Things are more relaxed, a little calmer, easier to get guys. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I think when we break down those topics individually, I think first and foremost, there is so much, I think, general league-wide optimism around spring training. You walk in, new start, everyone's got zeros next to their stats. It's really easy to go, hey, like, why can't it be us? And I do think there's a little more intrigue to that because you get a lot of players to have these conversations about what they're looking for this year to be. Some guys coming off of really great years or great finishes, some other guys coming off some poor finishes, but it's interesting. I think the Yankees would tell you that they had a strong year last year, but fans will tell you last year was a disaster because they didn't get out of the ALDS, and they brought back a lot of pieces from last year. So at least organizationally, I think they're telling you with their actions they like that roster. And Aaron Boone has said outright, I like this group. I'm glad we're bringing him back. Why is Brian Cashman not saying that? Do you feel as a beat writer that you're kind of being, for lack of better terms, you're kind of getting bullshitted to? Or do you feel like there's a layer to what he's trying to say that we're just not getting at home?
He is saying that, much like Boone has said that. Well, what Cashman said the other day was that he was disputing this idea that it is the same roster or a similar roster. And in doing so, he was talking a lot about trade deadline acquisitions. When, you know, the question posed to him was, you know, the roster now is very similar to what it was in the ALDS when the season ended. I don't think any Yankee fan wants to hear about the summer trade deadline on January 28th, which is when Cashman spoke. So my thing is, like, they believe in this roster. They believe in this group. They're very confident in that. Just say that and stand by that. You know, don't try to frame it in this disingenuous way or argue these semantics. Like, to me, even if you believe that truly and genuinely, like, it's just a losing battle with fans and even with us in the media. Like, their biggest additions this offseason have been Ryan Weathers, who could be really good, but right now projects as a back end of the rotation project starter. They got Angel Chavilla from the Rockies, who has really good stuff, but right now projects as a project. So if your two biggest acquisitions of the offseason are projects, and you also just re-signed a bunch of guys from last year's team, like, yes, it is a largely similar roster. I don't know why that became a point of contention. If you believe in that roster, say so, and then people are going to have their own opinions on that. But don't spin it as if it's something it's not.
Yeah, and I fully agree in the sense that just embrace it. Just embrace it, that's all. Like, if you embrace, if you go out and you say, hey, we have largely the same group as last year, you can't ignore that. But I like this group. We brought these players back because we think they're good. I've said this before, but like, Cody Bellinger is probably, what, the second best outfielder you could have gotten on this market? Is Trent Grisham maybe the best center fielder that changed teams or was available on the market? Maybe. Like, I think you can make really strong arguments for that. And that's a fine reason to acquire both players and keep them, but you got to embrace it. Just embrace that you're running back the same group. I mean, they're looking to maybe bring back a Paul Goldschmidt, maybe bring back an Austin Slater. Like, that's fine, but just embrace it. I think that, and I'm curious, again, because when you're in that media scrum, like, do you feel like the Yankees in general struggle to just shoot it straight with you in a way that should be expected of the organization, or do you feel like this was a more of a one-off incident?
Oh, no, that's par for the course. I mean, you know, I think any fans that are plugged in and watching regularly in these press conferences and scrums, I mean, particularly when it comes to leadership in the organization, there always seems to be some sort of spin that doesn't always make sense when there is a very clear and obvious explanation that, you know, they just said, hey, like, this is our reasoning, this is why. Well, okay, all right. Doesn't mean necessarily everybody will agree with that, but it's clear that sometimes they say things when there are other things that, you know, are the obvious answer. I'll give you an example. You know, last year, Aaron Judge comes back to the outfield after the flexor strain. He's limited in his throwing right off the start, you know, right off the bat. You know, there's that play against Toronto. Boone's talking about it first as if, like, nothing happened. Then it's like, okay, we're just not going to talk about it. Then the next day, he tells us that it's a creative cut, which didn't make any sense. Really, all Boone had to say was, yeah, Judge is limited in his throwing right now, which every team knows because teams have advanced scouts. It's not like that was a secret. Like, the upcoming opponents are scouting the Yankees before Yes. those teams play them. So it's not like you're protecting a state secret. Hey, Judge is limited in his throwing right now, but he gives more range than Giancarlo Stanton in the outfield, and also by not putting Stanton in the outfield, we're protecting him from further injury. Perfectly logical, reasonable explanation, but instead they made it into this like 2-3 day thing where it was like, oh no, no, what you saw is not what happened. And I don't really always understand that.
Yeah, and look, I understand maybe not revealing the extent of an injury if it's like, hey, this guy's not playing, we're gonna keep that to ourselves until we get an official MRI, let an official statement be released, whatever it may be, but with like the surface level obvious stuff, I just feel like it only serves to bring negative attention when I don't think there's a competitive disadvantage to, as you mentioned, telling the league what they know already, and I don't think there's a competitive disadvantage to, or really any disadvantage to the idea that, I don't know, the Incas are running it back. Like, that's, if you want to get technical, fine, but if you want to say, hey, we're running it back, but hey, we think we're getting this piece back, and this guy's going to help us a little more, and we're excited. I mean, he talked about the young pups, and we'll get into that, but I think, again, it would just be better for them to shoot straight. I don't think there's a downside to it in those cases. Again, I think there are exceptions, but there's just, I don't know. I don't think there's a reason outside of just creating a stir that doesn't need to be there. Now, some of the young pups, you wrote about this, and this is a segment I'm probably the most excited for in this podcast. We get to break down your story of the pod slash week. Well, again, we'll kind of figure that out as it goes, but you wrote this morning about that young pups comment that Brian Cashman made where he discussed some of the younger guys in the organization. Didn't name names, but you were talking about some of the people he was actually talking about. Gary, can you break down what that comment was about and who are these young pups who are on the way?
Yeah, so he did specifically mention Elmer Rodriguez and Carlos Lagrange, the top, two pitching prospects in the system, both just 22 years old. I would expect them to both be in Major League camp this spring. Again, still waiting on that NRI list from the Yankees. He also made references to Chavie from the Rockies, as well as Cade Winquist, so kind of lumped them in there in this article. And then I kind of threw on a extra name, another top pitching prospect, Ben Hess, just because Matt Blake was recently on the Yes Network, and he said that all three of those prospects are kind of ahead of where Cam Schlittler was at this point in his development last year. So figured, hey, might as well throw him in there. Three intriguing pitching prospects to focus on. Two bullpen options who are going to have a chance to make this opening day roster. So put together a little something just to get to know them a little bit more. And included some quotes from an interview I did with Blake earlier this offseason. It included Cashman's comments. Included some info from Winquist, who I also spoke to this offseason. So some good stuff there on some younger guys who are certainly going to get opportunities in camp.
And I think for me personally, Elmer's the most intriguing for at least the year, not immediately, but for the year, because he'll get some time in the World Baseball Classic to pitch in what are high intensity games, whether you individually as a viewer, listener, however you're listening to this, whether you believe it's very important or not is one thing. For the players, they take it very seriously. I imagine Elmer Rodriguez is going to pitch in this World Baseball Classic like, hey, this is the postseason. This is do or die. And I'm excited to see how he pitches in that environment. Who do you think has the better chance of making their big league debut this year between Elmer and Lagrange? I know proximity is a variable here, but who do you think is more likely and why is that the case?
I'm not sure yet. I want to see what they do with Lagrange in spring training and how he is used. I think, it's no secret that there's been some speculation that he might be better off long-term in the bullpen. Hey, short-term, that might be his most expeditious path to the major leagues with the way that the Yankees relief unit looks right now. So I'm curious to see if they use him in that capacity. I think he would be toward the further end of the depth chart as far as starting rotation options should the Yankees suffer more injuries and kind of whittle away at their depth this spring. So I could see a situation where, he's up in the bullpen sooner than later. He still hasn't pitched at Triple A, so he still has some development to do. Rodriguez only has one start at Triple A under his belt. I think in the Yankees' ideal world, neither of those guys are on an opening day roster or anything like that, but again, you go through spring, the early parts of the season, injuries happen. So I would certainly not rule out seeing those guys this year.
Yeah, and in Lagrange's case, I actually hadn't really thought about that, where the role, right? I guess Elmer's a more likely starter to come up, but just making your big league debut in general, if LaGrange is a reliever, there's a really good argument to make that he is closer to the big leagues than Elmer is as a starter, even though I think Elmer's not too far away. On the reliever side, you have, yeah.
One thing I wanted to add before we get to the relievers is that you mentioned Rodriguez pitching the WBC. One thing I do know is that his participation was contingent on him being in their rotation because he didn't want to deviate from the plan that the Yankees have him on.
That's awesome. That's sick. Well, I also want to see him pitch as a starter. I didn't really want to see some one inning to win because you can't really get a read for a guy in that scenario. Now, in the World Baseball Classic, it is treated like a postseason scenario, so I do imagine that it's not going to be, hey, go out there and pitch seven innings, and I don't think the Yankees would at all enjoy seeing their top prospect throw 90 pitches out of the gate. So his role will be condensed for starter, but I do think this gives him more leeway to build up, and I think that you can't hinder his development for the World Baseball Classic. Even though I love the tournament, I'm wearing my DR hat for this episode, and I will be for almost every video until the World Baseball Classic ends. But I do find it fascinating, again, what you talk about their roles. On the reliever note, with Winquest and Chavilly, Winquest was a Rule 5 pick. Chavilly was traded for Rumfield. You talk about the some of the young relievers here in this article. What is your sense you're getting from the organization and their trust level? Is it more of like fanfare, or do they actually believe these guys can be solutions to their bullpen issues?
I think it's more along the lines of that those two and a couple others are part of this whole collection of flyers that they're taking, right? Like, you've got them, you've got Jake Bird, who they were obviously high on when they traded for him last year, but didn't do well, was really overused by the Rockies before getting him. Brent Hedrick, they're high on. That they've got a couple NRIs coming to camp. Dylan Coleman, I know, is somebody that they're intrigued by. So I think they're trying to collect lottery tickets and hoping to hit the jackpot on more than one, which, well, personally, I do not think is a great strategy for a team with championship aspirations. It doesn't mean that it can't work. You know, we've seen the Yankees in years past with Blake, you know, at the helm as pitching coach, pick, you know, they've gotten lucky on some guys. They've found some diamonds in the rough. Usually it's one or two a season. I think right now you're maybe looking for more than that to fill out that bullpen, but I think that is the philosophy right now. And then if it gets to the point where, hey, these things are not working, this strategy did not pan out, okay, then you have another trade deadline like the Yankees did last year where they kind of overhaul their bullpen.
And I think We both are very aligned, I think, on the bullpen, where it's a situation of just go get a guy who you can rely on. I'm not saying it's got to be a top 10 or 20 reliever in the game, but you do have an incredible amount of injury risk and just performance risk in that bullpen. Chavis, like, a really, really talented arm, but, I mean, you're asking a 23-year-old to make a massive leap in development almost immediately if you want him to be impactful. If not, you're sending him to AAA, which I think is more likely than people think. With Winquest, I mean, he's got to prove it in spring training, and we've seen guys look good in spring training and not perform in season. This is not a deep pull, but kind of a deep pull. Nick Nelson in like 2021 had a phenomenal spring training, and he was awful that year and got traded at the end of the season. If Winquest has a good spring, I mean, how much of a leash can you even give him is my question in the regular season. Does he get like a month to struggle? Does he get 2 months to struggle before you make that decision to send him back to the Cardinals? I find his roster decision the most fascinating because it's not cut or keep, it's send back to the Cardinals or keep. There's not any middle ground outside of if he has a significant injury, if I'm not mistaken. What do you get the sense on with Winquest's chances of making the roster? Because it really is like, have a good spring or you're not a Yankee anymore.
Yeah, so for those that don't know, as a Major League Phase Rule 5 pick, Winquest has to not only make the opening day roster, but he has to stay on the active roster all season aside from an IL stint, or he gets exposed to waivers and potentially returned to the Cardinals or scooped up by somebody else. It's a long process for him to remain in the organization and get sent down to AAA. I will say that the Yankees have liked him for a while. You know, they almost considered drafting him in the same round that they took Cam Schlittler back in 2022 in the amateur draft. So they've been on him for a long time. He's got big stuff, big fastball, 12-6 curve. When I spoke to him earlier this offseason, he said that he and Matt Blake spoke about possibly adding a sinker. So how good does a chance does he have of making the roster? I'm not sure. It depends on what he does in camp. I do think they are looking at him as one of those potential lottery tickets. I think he is going to get the opportunity. You know, the Yankees had not made a Rule 5 pick in 14 years. So for them to do so tells you they like something about WinQuest. He'll get his opportunities.
Yeah, and I think, again, it'll be really fascinating to see how much this is a good litmus test for how much they focus on spring training, how much these results matter to them, what they look for in a spring training candidate. We kind of saw with like Ben Rice, he had like a one something average in spring, but he was hitting the ball hard. So they were like, hey, this guy is doing well in spring. So I'm curious to see what they do care about and how much weight they put into spring training. I don't want to finish this segment without talking about the final name that you wrote about on this article, because I think he is eternally snubbed from young pitcher conversations. And that's Ben Hess, who is not very far away. I know you mentioned that it had been talked about by Matt Blake, I think, on Hot Stove, that they view LaGrange and Elmer as further ahead than Schlittler was at the end of last year. Hess, if you look at his innings pitched in Double A, is on a similar timeline to Schlittler last year. Can you talk to us a little bit about why Ben Hess has some fans in the organization and what his timeline could look like?
Yeah, I think he came out of college a little ahead. I know his numbers there weren't great, but they really liked the stuff that he had, and that's very often how the Yankees are grading these pitchers. They're not just looking at ERA or surface level numbers. They're looking at the measurables, the metrics, that kind of stuff. Yeah, like you said, he's only pitched at Double A so far, or has only reached Double A so far, at only 36.2 innings last year. So even then, he's a little behind the other two pitching prospects, LaGrange and Rodriguez. I would think he probably starts the season there at Double A. You know, for all I know, the other two do as well. I think there's big fastball there, big stuff that they'd like to see him, you know, kind of master Double A, get a little more time there. And then from there, who knows how fast a guy shoots up the system. You know, we saw Schlittler jump multiple levels last year.
Yeah, and it's spring training is going to be awesome for these guys because you get to see them in big league camp and you get to see them, or at least for Elmer Uwilkie's on the 40-man. LaGrange is a probable, I'd say. Is that fair to say? He's like a probable for big league camp?
I would expect him to be in camp.
Okay.
In
big league what camp. About Hess? Would you say, think Hess is going to be there?
I don't know. I know. He's down there already. Blake mentioned that on the S Network the other day. All three of them are actually down there already, along with a bunch of other Yankees. So, but I'm not sure if he would be in big league camp or not.
Well, I hope we get to see them at least pitch once with some StatCast tracking to see kind of how their stuff looks. But this is a really exciting time for the system in that respect of they have started to build a better pipeline of minor league to major league pitching. And I think these three guys have what it takes to also reach the big leagues. Now, whether they end up being effective big leaguers or not, I always caution against this. The median, even really good prospect does not end up being a superstar. I don't want any of this talk to be conflated with us saying, oh, this is the next, you know, Pedro Martinez or Garrett Cole. Like, these guys are talented. The Yankees like them. We'll see if they end up, you know, becoming the kinds of pitchers who make an impact on a championship contender. I think this does lead into the overall question about this pitching staff, though, because I think there is a little bit too much reliance on, I think we can make this guy better kind of approach to the bullpen and a little bit to the rotation, too. I don't think they have enough to say that they've got, like, I don't think they have, I think they have enough to get through a season, but I'm not in love with the pitching staff. What are your big questions with this staff, bullpen, rotation as a whole?
Like I said, I think the bullpen has some real questions. The Yankees have been averse to spending big on relievers for a while now. That's something I know we want to ask about in spring training, just why. I mean, I think the answer that they'll give us is that they do have a pretty solid track record of finding these diamond in the rough types. I mean, look at last year's bullpen. You could argue there was as much star power in there as they've had in a couple years, and still wasn't very good, right? So I guess their sense is, why spend big when we've shown we can mold our own for cheap? The rotation, I think the rotation has the potential to be really good if everybody can be at their best and healthy at the same time? Obviously, that is a huge if. I mentioned it earlier, but Gerrit Cole, Carlos Rodon, Clark Schmidt are all starting the season on the IL. Cole and Schmidt are coming off of Tommy John surgery, which, you know, guys can come back from and be their previous selves, but also there's usually some rust involved at the bare minimum. So that's something to keep in mind. I know the Yankees are really banking on having Cole back. Might be a little bit of an adjustment period. Who knows? You also have to consider that Max Fried, Cam Schlittler, Will Warren, they are all coming off of career-high workloads. Now, are they going to get through another spring and another season healthy? It's a big question mark. Like that's a real thing to think about. On top of that, Ryan Weathers is an injury risk. Luis Gil is an injury risk. For depth, you have Ryan Yarbrough. I imagine Paul Blackburn will also be stretched out for a starter's workload, at least in spring training. And then after that, you got the pitching prospects. So I think there's a lot of talent there. I think there's certainly more than five arms, right? But can they avoid more injuries? Can the guys who are returning from injury be themselves right off the bat? Will there be a rust period, an adjustment period? Who knows?
I think with the rotation, I would agree, like, there's a little more certainty there, mainly because of the guys who are coming back, and also the fact that, you know, they do have enough arms where you can hope to get through the period without Cole and Rodon. It's not as if, like, I don't think there's a depth issue immediately. I guess that could become an issue with injuries, but I don't think you can pencil in three starting pitching injuries every year. Some years you have some really bad springs for your health, which is like last year, or some years you only lose one guy. I mean, some years you may not lose anybody in your starting five. So that is more of a we'll see. The bullpen, I feel like they really should just add that reliable seventh or eighth inning guy and just push everybody down the depth chart a bit. If you pushed one of Doval and Cruz, or at least the project guys, down one spot in the depth chart, you feel a lot better about the bullpen. It just gives you a little more of that security, especially early in the season, because I'm curious to see if this is something that Boone has to talk about in the presser. Who is he going to if they, like, I'm sure he's not going to be able to answer that in the start of spring training, but close to the opening day, who are you going to? You're going to Duval, you're going to Cruz, you're going to Bednar, maybe Hill, but what's the game plan? You can't burn these guys.
My question is, what happens when you have a stretch where Cruz and Duvall, who are both very nasty, but also very erratic, what happens when you have a stretch where they're both currently erratic and off their game, which happened last year, right? Like, usually when those guys, you know, were not at their best, it was for a period of time. So what happens when there's an overlap? You're going to burn David Bednar out for five saves once, twice a week? Like, that can't be the solution. And right now, you don't know if anybody else in that bullpen, aside from Tim Hill in lefty specialist situations, is, you know, capable of handling high leverage. So that, to me, is something to think about, something to keep an eye on. I also think it's interesting that the Yankees have their top three relievers all pitching in the World Baseball Classic.
Yeah, and look, there's an argument to be made that there's data out there that suggests starting pitchers have some issues when they participate in the WBC in the following season, but that's that's kind of wishy-washy. I'm not sure I'd really buy into that. For relievers, I don't know how I feel about that. On one hand, that is increased injury risk. On the other hand, do they get ready or do they feel comfortable in big spots sooner? Like, I don't know. Especially for Duvall and Cruz, they're very command, their command stinks. So does it help to not have to go through, like, the March, April, I don't know where the ball's going? I don't know. That's, I guess, its own internal conversation. How do you feel about that?
I will say that Duvall pitched in the WBC in 2023, and that was his best season as a big leaguer. So maybe there's something to that, you know, getting those high intensity reps out of the way in an earlier part of the year. I think it probably varies guy to guy. Also, past success doesn't guarantee future success, right? Yes. So that's just a note that I'm making, an observation, not a prediction or anything like that. I will say the Yankees have spoken very highly of Duvall this offseason. They believe they figured out some things with his mechanics and his tempo toward the end of the last season. I know that work has continued with him in a hands-on manner this offseason, with, you know, coaches going to the Dominican Republic to visit him and work with him. So maybe we see some changes right off the bat in camp or in the WBC. Who knows? definitely he's somebody to keep an eye on, though.
Yeah, and I'm hoping he pitches well in the World Baseball Classic. I have a vested interest in that man pitching well. And I'm gonna have to root against Cruz a little bit if PR and DR match up. So that's gonna be I've got some interesting like conflicts with Yankees on rosters and what I'm gonna be watching for. I gotta watch some games that have nothing to do with DR that might take place in 2 a.m. So that is gonna be fun for me to do during March. Now, I wanted to get to our kind of one of the final notes that you mentioned in the storylines. That was with Cody Bellinger, because his contract is weird. Not in a good or bad way, just weird. Like it's just odd. There are some weird terminology in there. Gary, can you break down a little bit what you know about the contract and why it has any ties to the upcoming labor conflict we'll have?
Yeah, so it was previously reported that Bellinger's opt-outs are tied to a potential work stoppage in 2027 with owners and players' unions set to fight about a salary cap yet again. I thought that was interesting. You know, Bellinger has opt-outs after the first 2 years of his contract, or after the second and third years of his contract. Sorry. So that is the second and third played seasons, the way his contract is written out, which when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's interesting. But like, it also makes sense because people are expecting a work stoppage, whether that be a lockout more likely, and then also a strike. I contacted somebody at the Players Union and was just curious, like, hey, has this been a thing with deals that have options that are signed this offseason? And they basically told me, like, this is not standard. They wouldn't say if anybody else has received this perk, but basically it was like, this is not standard. It hasn't been standard in off seasons previously where there was a looming work stoppage expected. So I just thought that was interesting. Like, players are clearly thinking about this labor battle. Agents are thinking about it. Teams are thinking about it. And I thought it was interesting that the Yankees were willing to give that perk among several others in this contract. And I thought it was interesting that Bellinger and Scott Boras thought to ask for it, and that either other players and agents are not, or they haven't gotten it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting how this work stoppage is going to occur, considering the World Baseball Classic's happening this year. I know there's just naturally going to be WBC talk on this because of the fact that we are a month away from it starting and there's a lot of Yankees on it, but there's going to be a surge in interest in Major League Baseball. So I am curious as to all of the dynamics that are going to go into this. It didn't feel like the last work stoppage and CBA agreement was an end to things. It felt more like a temporary pause or a kicking the can down the road in terms of a very tense relationship between Major League Baseball's owners and players, the Player Association. It was nasty last time. I don't think it's going to be any nicer or cleaner this time. So is there anything that you, not like hearing necessarily, but how you feel or your perspective on this, do you think it's going to be worse than last time in terms of how nasty this ends up getting?
I think, gun to my head, or if I were to make a bet on such a thing, I would say it's going to be longer, and it's going to be more drawn out, and it's going to be more heels dug in. I mean, the owners really want a salary cap, and the players' union essentially exists to prevent such a thing. So it's kind of hard to come to a middle ground there.
And I know people say, well, we've got salary caps in like the NBA and the NFL. The NBA salary cap is like 90%. The NBA salary floor, excuse me, is like 90% of the salary cap, if my math is correct. The floor is not low in these leagues. The floor is really high. So I don't think owners are agreeing to a system where if the cap is, let's say, conservatively $300 million, that the floor is going to be 250 or even 200. I mean, I don't think you can even get like a 180 floor in this league right now.
Yeah, I think they're going to shoot for a discrepancy between the two numbers that is going to be a non-starter. And on top of that, like, I just don't see why the players would give in to any cap at all. People may not realize this, but like the Major League Baseball Players Association is one of the, if not the strongest unions in the world. Not just sports. Like, they have incredible power and leverage here. And this is just something I can't see them going for, even if there is a really high floor. But it's something that's going to play out over time. we'll hear more, I'm sure, from the league and the union as time goes on. It's certainly going to be a discussed topic throughout the season, not only with the Yankees, but across Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and even in sports like the NBA, there's a salary cap at $154 million, but teams break it. Teams break the salary cap. They go beyond it. So I don't even know. And the NBA has different structures with contracts. There's max contracts. It's determined on voting. You'd have to literally break down Major League Baseball's pay structure and reshape it entirely, I think, to make a cap floor system work. And I think that is where you're going to get part of that drawn outness, where even if players can sign on to the idea of, all right, NBA players get paid, we can get paid in that kind of system, you're not going to get owners to agree to an NBA style cap floor system in any, no chance. I think that happens. So yeah. Are there any final thoughts you have on the potential up or not potential, the upcoming work stoppage we're expected to have?
I guess just if I had to guess, and I want to stress this is a guess, we end up with a similar system to what there is now, just increased penalties for the taxes, lower tax thresholds, maybe something along those lines. I just don't see why players would agree to a cap right now.
Neither do I. And I also think, I don't think baseball, or at least the top spenders, which these owners do have a ton of influence over votes, if I'm not mistaken. Like Hal Steinbrenner has a pretty sizable influence on other owners and how he'll vote. Steve Cohen, the Dodgers, I'm sure they have some. Like, I don't think they're operating in the manner of, we're going to be capped to $300 million in 2027. Am I crazy to think that?
It's hard to tell. I mean, like, I think people need to remember that the owners vote as a block more than they vote as competitors. It's not like, you know, maybe with the exception of the Dodgers group and Steve Cohen, it's not like Hal Steinbrenner is saying, oh, I can spend $320 million, so that gives me an advantage over all these other teams. I should vote against this. No, Hal Steinbrenner has come out and said that he is in favor of a salary cap so long as there is a reasonable salary floor. Now, his opinion of what a reasonable floor might differ from what the Pittsburgh Pirates think a reasonable floor is. You know, maybe that creates some debate, some tension. But yeah, the owners are a voting bloc. You know, the players, more often than not, are a voting bloc. Now, you go down the ladder and you get to sub-issues and things like that. Yes, there's disagreement on different things and different interests among the richest of the rich and the poor and the relatively poor, you know, factions in those groups. So it's going to be a lot to discuss, a lot to talk about. It's not exactly a storyline I'm looking forward to, just because it really is a black cloud or a dark cloud over the sport. But it's going to come up this year.
Yeah, it's an unwanted but unfortunately a necessary conversation. It's going to hang over the head of the 2026 season. Like, I remember that 21 year, and this was, we kind of knew that there was going to be some sort of work stoppage at various points during the regular season, but that was a cloud hanging over that year's head. It's going to be, I think, magnified because the World Baseball Classic, because there are, you know, tons of metrics that suggest that the World Series is gaining viewership. Because of the traction baseball is getting on the viewership stage, it, I think, only will create more fan vitriol when there's no baseball. I think it'll only create, and the Dodgers will only create more vitriol from owners to have a cap and players. I'm not looking forward to this. Let's move on to our mailbag because we've got questions from our viewers, and we want to thank everybody, by the way, who submitted. For those who submitted questions under tweets over the last 4 or 5 days or in our YouTube post, those questions will also be considered for a future mailbag. So if your question didn't get answered today, don't think that your question just disappears and gets deleted. It's under consideration for other episodes, but we only had so many questions we could take. There are some overlap on questions, but we want to thank everybody. Gary, we're going to start with this question from Anthony Romano, and it's, have you noticed the industry change since you've been a part of it? I want you to answer that however broadly or specifically you'd like to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'll use this podcast as an example, right? Like, I think there's way more independent media, new media, content creators. I think when I was first coming out of college or even in college, it was more, you know, blogs were considered the non-traditional and the new media. I think that has shifted way more to podcasts, to social media, you know, companies that really focus on social media. Obviously, you've seen, you know, traditional media, newspapers like the New York Daily News, shrink, lay people off, downsize, things like that. You know, I'm very fortunate to have a newspaper position and be covering a major beat for a paper and you know, have a physical product to hold in my hand. That's obviously just not the way the world in general is going. So that was part of the reason why I was interested in doing this podcast and doing stuff with Fireside, because I do think there is room for both. I think it's healthy to have both, but there certainly is more podcast content creators, new media, than when I was first starting in the business and coming out of college.
And I know I'm kind of interjecting with a question a little bit here, but when you talk about new media and old media, I think there is a growing sense of I don't know if the word's growing I want to use or a le- there's not enough. There's a growing sentiment that I don't think values old media enough among fans. Can you talk about why it's important to have old? I don't even know if the word's old media, but to have these objective observers of what's going on in not just the sports world, but the world in general.
I'm only 31, so let's call it traditional media.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's important because, you know, there are just certain standards and practices and ways that, you know, a traditional journalist or reporter is taught to go about things. And that's not to say that new media can't, or that a fan with a credential can't do those things. But, you know, I have a certain level of, you know, how do I want to verify something? How do I want to frame something that might be controversial? How do I want to contextualize things? You know, I think you, Ryan, and the guys at Fireside do a really good job of, even though you're coming from a fan perspective, of holding yourselves to a high standard, an informative standard, an insightful standard. I don't think that's true of every new media company or personality, and that's not even to, you know, a fault of their own. You know, they might not have a journalism background or a journalism education. You know, this is something I studied for 4 years in school. And that's not even to say they get everything, you know, a new media person gets everything wrong or a traditional media person gets everything right. None of us are perfect. And that's why I think there's room for everyone. But, you know, I'm going to agonize over not getting something right. I'm going to agonize over how I frame a certain story, if it's controversial or if it has the potential for negative implications on somebody's life away from the baseball field, things like that. I've seen some stuff on Yankees Twitter from new media companies that don't hold themselves to the same standards as myself or other beat reporters or the way Fireside and Ryan does things. And it's like, it's irresponsible at times. And I'm talking about more than just being rah-rah and a fan and, you know, rooting for the team that you're covering or posting about, things like that. Now, there was an example I saw yesterday that I don't want to give too much air or life to, but it was connecting the Yankees to, you know, a very real-world political issue right now going on, and it wasn't really like a straight arrow. It was more like desperately connecting the dots, and it was for nothing more than engagement and content farming, and that's not right. That's not the standard that I'm going to hold myself to. It's not the standard that traditional media typically holds itself to. There's exceptions. There's reporters. There's companies that post things for clicks. And baits and bait, and they don't contextualize things. And that drives me crazy, because I think, you know, with the Yankees, when we're in the clubhouse, you know, I think we're all kind of seen as one. And I want to make sure I'm not doing that when I'm looking at new media, right? Like, Ryan's not the same as X is not the same as Y. That's kind of how I look at it.
And I think it's really insightful, too, because we're not using the terms right or wrong media. We're using the terms that I think describe what it is. It's traditional new media. There's ways to go about both in the right and wrong ways. I think that's an important thing to note with all this. And I think it's, again, I think it's really going to be fascinating to see how the future of media continues to evolve. And I think those kinds of these kinds of conversations are a real big reason why we're doing this. And I'm really happy that we can have these conversations.
I mean, the Daily News doesn't have a vivid, you know, social media presence. The Daily News doesn't have a YouTube channel. Like, are those, at least not for sports and for the Yankees, like, are those things we should probably have in 2026? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've always just been a writer. You know, that was really all I focused on in college was, you know, I went to Seton Hall, focused on the school paper there, did very little radio, did very little TV stuff. But like, those are skills that as we get more and more digital, more and more on social media, that I should have. You know, there's no other objective way to look at it, right? So I'm excited to be doing this. I'm excited to be kind of merging the old and the new. And yeah, really looking forward to talking more about this type of stuff on the pod as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think it's the kind of conversation that needs to be had, because as we keep going into the future is just going to happen, right? Like, things are just going to happen, whether we want it to happen, whether we don't want it to happen, it's going to happen. And with how media is going, I think these conversations are good to make sure we understand why things were the way they were, and why those things, some of those things should be the way they are. Maybe some things should change. We'll have those in-depth conversations as we keep doing this. Now, the second question that we wanted to highlight here was still very much reliant on the storytelling aspect of it, and it's what something that you have learned along the way that has improved your storytelling.
I think this was from Anthony Romano as well. Yes. Shout out to Anthony for getting two questions in here on the debut pod. When I was in college, I had a professor who told me, venture beyond your own backyard. And the context there was, I was always, whether it was for the school paper or for class, I was always writing, you know, sports stories about the sports themselves, right? I said earlier that, you know, I'm always, now I'm as little interested in what's happening on the field as possible. That's because of Anthony DePalma, former Seton Hall professor, former New York Times contributor. And he was basically challenging me, like, okay, anybody can write about the game that they just watched. Tell me about the players' lives. Tell me about how the game intersects with race, politics, religion, entertainment, business, all these things. And that's going to make me a better reporter. And I think he was spot on. Like, I think all these years later, like, I try to live by that. I try to follow that constantly. I'm always looking for those threads and trying to connect those dots. And taking that approach has led me to some of my favorite stories that I've ever written. So I always try to keep that in mind. I always try to keep in mind the idea that everybody has a story to tell. That's why I come up with a list of every single guy in Yankees camp every single year. Because, like, you never know who is going to blossom or develop, or who might not even have any chance of making the team, but has a really good, interesting story to tell. Those are the things I'm always looking for.
And these are people. Like, they're not just the guy who might help you in a World Series or not. They're people. I think that variable doesn't get discussed enough. And I think that's, especially when we were coming up with this podcast concept, and we've had you on before this, like, that was one of the things I always really liked about your writing, which was the fact that there was a conversation to be had that was greater than just, yeah, this guy's got a good fastball. Here's why his fastball's good. That's it. Like, I think there's so much more to sports and to these athletes than just that, and I always am fascinated to hear these stories.
There's plenty of reporters who are going to focus on just the games, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. If that's your thing, like, read those reporters, read those writers, no offense taken whatsoever. That's not where my interests are. That's not where my bread and butter is. If I'm writing game stories, if I'm writing stuff about just the baseball, it's because, you know, that's the news of the day, or I got to fill physical space in a newspaper, or I got to just get something in for that day. You know, in my free time or my extra work time, whatever you want to call it, like, I'm looking for those features and those human interest pieces.
So what I'm hearing is the August 10th stories are going to be very much baseball stories, or baseball on-field stories when it's game 1-10 and they lost their fifth straight to the the homeless athletics right now? What is the, do we have an official city designation from MLB?
It's the Sacramento.
Okay. Athletics. Okay. No, I wasn't sure if MLB gave them the Sacramento thing yet. Like, I don't know if they let that happen or if they're just,
I thought they were putting it, if they didn't start last year, they were putting it on the jersey.
You're right. I did forget about that. So yeah, that's the stretch we're going to get the very baseball heavy stuff, as I imagine. Is that a good guess? Is that a time frame for that?
Yeah. I also try not to repeat stories. Like, there are certain weeks, especially in the dog days of summer, where it's like, we talked about this guy getting injured on Friday, and on Saturday there's a non-update, and on Sunday there is an update. It's like, all right, like, I trust that the readers know what is going on, and I don't need a full-fledged article every single step of the way. Again, sometimes I gotta fill space, sometimes I gotta submit something. August is, in fact, typically a time where the creative juices are running a little dry because you're coming off the trade deadline and, you know, your focus is there and your attention's there. But I do my best to come up with stuff that's unique, quirky, offbeat, off the field. That's my approach to the job.
Yeah, and I really respect that. And I mean, coming off the Bellinger stuff, I think the non-update portion of that segment is very important. I mean, every week was, hey, the Yankees really, they're moving on. They don't want this guy. And then a day later, they had talked with him. They're updating this. They're giving him that now. I'm glad it's over for a lot of reasons. Now, yeah, that's, no, I just, that, I don't have fun doing that. Now, from Mads on, we have another question from Twitter. This is from Madison. I think it's Madison DeStefano. I think that's how you pronounce it, but I'm really bad with last names, so I really apologize. And she asked, what's your favorite part about the job? So I like that these are broad questions because you can take them whatever way you want to, but go ahead, please.
I know people probably think it's talking to the players or watching games for free. The best part about my job is the other writers. We have such a great rapport on the beat, particularly Chris Kirshner, Brendan Cuddy, Pete Caldera, Brian Hoke. A shout out to, you know, formerly of the beat, now on the Mets beat, Max Goodman. Greg Joyce is great. Eric Bolin is great. Like, it's a really nice group that at least I feel like I get along with everybody. And enjoy being around just about everybody. So we eat together on the road. We go on, you know, field trips to different, like, tourist attractions that I'm typically organizing and coordinating media passes and getting in touch with the PR reps for those organizations. So, like, I've already put in a request for Alcatraz when the Yankees are in San Francisco on opening day. I know some restaurants I want to make sure I return to in Seattle on the second half of that trip. I show up to work every day. I laugh my ass off. We joke around. We have a great time on the beat. And I'm fortunate that some of these guys have become my closest friends.
That's awesome. I love to hear that. It was, you know, people don't talk about enough with Max Goodman. That's a tough loss for the beat writer game you guys put at the Red Sox guys. That's a tough loss, man.
Yeah, I'm going to miss Max. He's not too far away now, going to Queens.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've already joked about how he won't be around this spring or on some of these trips or in the press box in the Bronx. So got to make some plans outside of work.
Yeah. And again, it's awesome seeing too how you guys support each other's work a lot. I think that's really cool. I think it makes, I think, the quality of everybody's work better too. You guys just constantly push out great stuff. We have really, like, there's really good coverage of the New York Yankees. And I think a lot of people confuse it as like, oh, they're not holding them accountable, not putting their feet to the fire. But if you read the articles, I think it's a really impartial and objective standpoint of the Yankees. It's not, you know, I know there's a lot of discourse about what Yankee media can be at times, but if you read the articles, you'll find there is a lot of really good stuff and a lot of, it's not too high when things are going well, not too low when things are going poorly, which I think is a good way to follow a baseball team over 162 games.
I think people also need to keep in mind, and maybe this is a traditional media thing versus a new media thing, like we were talking about before, but, like, speaking for not only myself, but I think the vast majority of the beat, like, we don't care if the Yankees win or lose. And that's not to say we're rooting for them to lose or rooting for them to win. Like, we're indifferent. In journalism school and classes, you're taught to, you know, from a sports perspective anyway, you're taught you root for good people, good stories, and fast games. Like, I don't see any reason why to root for anything else, you know? You could say if the Yankees went to the World Series and they won, like, maybe that presents some additional opportunities for a beat writer, you know, if I wanted to write a book or something, or maybe there's more TV appearances or podcast or radio appearances, something like that. On the flip side, they didn't make the playoffs in 2023, and I got an extra month of my offseason. So, like, there's pros and cons to it. I get paid the same whether, you know, they're done in, at the end of September, or whether they play for another month. So I'm just rooting for good people and good stories.
Yeah, and I think that is a big, I think, misconception with how people think the business is at times, where even if a team is bad, you can make their stories to come out of that. Like, there is, as long as you can create a story out of it, like, the result, it isn't like good is a good Yankee team is always a good story. I mean, the Yankees were good last year, and I think there were stretches where it was kind of hard to put stuff together, I'd imagine. That was a 94-win team. There weren't a lot of teams that won more games than that. So there's, again, it's win the World Series, or if you're really bad, you could argue, like, if the Yankees won 60 games, there's going to be a lot to talk about if they win 60 games next year, no?
I've never covered a truly terrible team. Like, even in 2023, when the Yankees didn't make the playoffs, like, they were just over 500, you know? In college, my first year or second year at Seton Hall, they started off where they were like number 19 in the country at the start of Big East play, and then they didn't even get an invitation to the NIT. But like, they were a train wreck. They weren't bad from the beginning. They weren't expected to be bad or supposed to be bad. I've never covered like a truly terrible or rebuilding team, and part of me thinks it would be interesting too. Like, certainly different types of stories. It would challenge my creativity and my reporting skills in a different way, I'm sure, depending on the situation. So I don't expect that anytime soon, though, with the Yankees.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, again, I just find it, I think it's fascinating how, and I guess I really thought about that. Like, there hasn't really been a moment for you yet where you're like, you're covering like a 162 of just the worst baseball you could possibly see. My quantification of that in my head is, as you mentioned, that 23 team, and they won 82 games. So, I mean, I'm a Giants fan, so I watch the Giants, and I know what completely terrible seasons look like from that standpoint, but covering it's a whole other animal. And baseball is just such a long season. That's neither here nor there. I think it's a good point to move on to the next question here, which comes from Zachary Goldstein, and it's, who are your favorite players to talk to in terms of personality and time allocation? Zachary, thank you for the question.
Jazz is, I think, probably everybody's answer at this point. I mean, he's never not giving you a good quote or something to talk about. So he's very high on my list. Oswaldo Cabrera is always just a pleasure to talk to, whether it's in a reporting scenario or you're just casually chatting with him. I mean, he is, even throughout the injury last year, always positive, always upbeat, always happy, treats everybody the same, whether it's the reporters or Aaron Judge or the clubbies. Like, he's just all-around great guy. What you see on camera is reality, exactly what you get. I would say he's one of my favorite guys to just chat with.
He is so forthcoming. It's pretty, like, he just, it's very, it's such a departure from the Yankees. I've never really seen something like it, where the personality, it hasn't been reined in yet. And I don't mean reined in as in like he has to tone it down or anything, literally in the sense of he hasn't had to dial it down at all. And I think that's cool. I like that. I like that he's very honest.
You're talking about Jazz or?
Yes, Jazz. Sorry, yeah, Jazz. Yeah, Jazz, think, yes.
It was funny. He got to spring training last year and a couple of and whatever his opening scrum was the first time we all talked to him, like, he was just rattling off like great quotes, and a couple of us hung around afterwards and said to him, like, we were worried, like, you know, maybe full off season with the team, like, media training had got to you, PR had gotten to you, and he was like, no, I'm never changing.
I love that. It's awesome for it's awesome to see a departure in that regard. I like a little person. I'm not saying everybody's got to be a quote machine, but I do love it. I think it's cool. And for Oswaldo, I got to run into him at an event in Jersey 2 years ago, and he's actually just always smiling. It's kind of crazy. I don't understand how that's possible. He just is always smiling. It's awesome. Like, he is like the happiest person I've ever seen in my life. Always. It's always a smile, or like, I don't know, maybe he has a resting smile face. I don't know if that's how he is in the clubhouse, but
no.
Yeah.
I think when he got hurt is like the only time I've seen him not happy ever.
Like, yeah.
I mean, he really does just walk around with a smile on his face.
That type of positivity, it's what everybody needs in their life. You know, it's a great thing to see somebody just smile all the time, man. Like, that's credit to him. I don't know. I don't think I could do it, but credit to somebody who can, especially in this world. For the penultimate question, we have a question I want to save for last specifically. This one's actually probably the most Yankee baseball related, on-field related, and it's, what's Cashman's plan with Jason and Spencer now that they've both been brought back? Now they brought back both Trent and Bellinger, really stumbling over this one, and Bellinger having that multi-year deal as well. So this is from Shiesty Judge. I want to shout him out. Thank you so much for the question. What are your thoughts on the outfield situation now?
I mean, barring any sort of injury in spring training, at best, Jason Dominguez is your fourth outfielder right now, and Spencer Jones is starting the year at AAA, which, by the way, is where I think he probably should start the year. I mean, there's still a ton of swing and miss concerns there that he needs to demonstrate or something he can at least mitigate and cut back on. Dominguez, you know, it's not an ideal situation for a player at this point in his career. You know, I think earlier in this offseason, there was a higher likelihood maybe of him getting traded if the Yankees knew that Bellinger was coming back. You know, they were interested in some higher-end starting pitchers who got traded elsewhere. Freddy Peralta and, to a lesser extent, Mackenzie Gore. Obviously, that did not pan out, so you're not just going to give him up for nothing. You know, maybe he still gets traded for a starter or, you know, a better bullpen piece. I don't know, but the Yankees aren't just going to give up on him for nothing of substance in return. I mean, they are still high on him. They do still think he has the potential to be a really good player in this league, but they've got a locked in outfield right now, and they've got three options who are better than him. He's really pigeonholed in left field. They don't see him as a center fielder, and even the defense in left, everybody knows, is a question mark. He still also has to show that he can, you know, improve from the right side. I mean, if he could do that, there might be a way for him to find a little bit more playing time. You know, Yankees are obviously looking for a right-handed bat, but that's also a work in progress or a question mark. So he's kind of in this limbo situation for the time being. Maybe somebody like Giancarlo Stanton gets hurt. I mean, that always seems to happen, right? Suddenly some DH at-bats become available, but right now, season started today, he's your fourth outfielder, and it kind of just is what it is.
It's also fascinating because the Yankees have been open to trading him, but the scenarios where that's the case are like the obvious, oh yeah, you would trade Jason, that scenario. It's not like they're dangling him and going, yeah, we'll take Brady Singer for Jason Dominguez. Like, that's not their mentality with that, as you noted. So it's such a weird situation. It's not even like I don't think they mishandled him either. He just didn't outplay Grisham, and Grisham broke out and hit 34 home runs, and nobody could have seen that coming. Jason was the unquestioned starting left fielder going into spring training last year, unless I'm misremembering that. Like, I don't think there was a world. No. I don't think there was a real competition between him and Grisham.
No, he was the left fielder. I mean,
yeah.
Trent was going to be the fourth outfielder. I know some Yankees fans feel, and I was debating this with somebody on Twitter the other day, like, I know some people feel like the Yankees have done wrong by him. Dominguez, that is. I mean, he got the audition in 2023, looked great, but then he gets hurt, obviously, so that cuts into his development in 24. Even still, he gets a chance to supplant Verdugo at the end of the season. Obviously was not ready defensively, which, you know, the Yankees would not say when we kept asking about when are you going to call up Dominguez, but, you know, it showed itself to be true once he was up there. And then last year, he's given the left field job and just gets outplayed. The defense is not there yet. I guess the only thing you could argue, like, against, you know, in favor of this idea that he's been wronged is maybe they should have moved him off center field sooner, considering they don't think he can play there now. But my counterpoint to that would be he hasn't played in a lot of professional baseball games because of his injuries, because of COVID. So, like, the Yankees didn't get a ton of time to evaluate him in center field, even as a minor leaguer. Could they have probably done some things better, or, you know, proceeded with a little more caution in some regards? Yeah, but I think there's a middle ground between that and he got jerked around, or, you know, they're doing wrong by him.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is either hindsight or just circumstantial. I think there's no single obvious thing they could have done to change what ended up going down, which is unfortunate for Jason. It's unfortunate for the Yankees to a degree, but not a bad thing to have depth either. It's not a bad thing to have an option, a built-in option on your roster that, hey, John Carlson goes down, I know exactly who I'm plugging in, because we have seen with previous teams that wasn't always the case. And last year was really the first time they lost Stanton and they kind of seamlessly replaced him, which was with Rice. But again, you're now Rice, your first baseman. So we'll see what ends up happening there. The final question we have for you, Gary, is what's this last week before camp looking like for you? What is the preparation week before spring training?
Yeah, so I mentioned that list of all the guys coming to camp. I want to make sure I have that finished at least by the time I touch down in Tampa. That might mean some last-minute finishing touches on the plane down there. We'll see. Got to pack. Got to go get a haircut. As you can see, this is out of control right now. What else do I got to do? Spend some time with family. Spend some time with my girlfriend and friends, hopefully. Got a Super Bowl party coming up on Sunday. And yeah, if I can get a hold of my editor, I'm going to ask for a couple days off and, you know, pre-write a couple things in advance and get ready to rock and hit the ground running in spring training.
Yeah, baseball is right around the corner, man. And I guess, you know, this is not a question written down, but who you got for the Super Bowl? Who you think is winning?
Oof. I don't know. I'm going to be honest. I grew up a Jets fan. I have not watched much NFL football over the last couple of years, especially since I started this job. You cover sports so much and you spend so much time around baseball. It's hard to tell your girlfriend or your family or your friends, like, oh, also, I need to watch this football game and I need to watch this Knicks game. And yeah, they don't want to hear that. So my NFL knowledge is not what it used to be.
Gotcha. I'm pulling for the Seahawks, not just out of Patriots hate watching. I have my little brother's a Seahawks fan, so I'm pulling for the Seahawks. The whole house is pulling for the Seahawks. And then obviously I can't stomach to watch the Patriots win another Super Bowl. It's not fair. It's just not fair.
I certainly don't want to see the Patriots win.
Totally fair. You see, you don't have to have like the objectivity with the NFL. Yeah. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah, and it'd be nice to see Sam Darnold win. I mean, that's a pretty crazy story. I mean, I don't think he was any good with the Jets, but they also didn't set him up for much success. So,
see, that's an example of maybe a young player not being set up for success, perhaps. I think it's also pretty bad. Yeah, like, that's what I was going to say. He was awful.
Everybody was at fault. You know, I was running a Jets website for USA Today during those years, so I was watching every Jets game, and all the things can be true. Like,
yes,
they didn't get him good weapons. They didn't get him an offensive line. His coaches were boneheads, and also he was not that good.
Yeah. Again, he was seeing ghosts out there. Now, right. Seeing maybe I hope he does not do something like that in the Super Bowl. But yeah, I mean, Gary, I think this was an incredible first episode. I'm really excited for everyone at home to get to listen to this. We're recording in the afternoon, so you'll be listening to this in the evening. I can't know when you're going to be listening to this in the evening, but it will be dropped in the evening. Gary, any final thoughts you have before we wrap things up here? What's on the radar potentially?
Just want to reiterate that I'm really excited to be doing this. Not super well-versed or experienced in podcasting. So listeners, if you've got any feedback, any suggestions, we're certainly open to them. Certainly want to hear them and really appreciate everybody that sent in questions. Appreciate everybody that's listened up to the end here and looking forward to doing this a lot more throughout the season.
Absolutely, absolutely. I almost shoehorned this out, and I apologize. I almost forgot about this. But is there anything we've got to be looking out for on the New York Daily News from you before you head to spring training?
I got a couple bigger projects I'm working on that I would say are in the potential stage, not the definite stage or the upcoming stage. So we'll see how things go this spring, and you know, during some of my downtime during the spring. And for those that don't know, I'll be there for the first 15 days. Then I come home, spend some time here. I'll work with like whatever leftover material I've stockpiled for features, analysis, that kind of stuff. And then I'm back down there for the March 16th to the 22nd. And then it's back home for a day or two while the Yankees finish up spring training in Arizona this year. And I will meet them in San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. I'm really excited for baseball to be back. I'm excited to kind of see what ends up unfolding in spring training. Maybe a little bit fearful because it's the most injury-prone time of year for pitchers. So a little bit of it's a nice, healthy mix. It's kind of like it's getting me ready for baseball. I'm excited and I'm also anxious. It's great. Thank you guys so much for tuning in here on Fireside Yankees. You can obviously check out Gary's work on the New York Daily News. For his Twitter account and his Twitter handle, it is Gary H. Phillips. Again, on Twitter, that's at Gary H. Phillips. The overlay will have it. We don't see the overlay right now, but you guys will be seeing it. So if you are someone like me who can't spell very well, it'll be on there. And you guys can check out this on Apple, Spotify. If you're listening there, drop a 5-star rating on the YouTube. Like, subscribe, turn on that notification bell, and follow us on our social pages. Links to everything will be in the description. We appreciate you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll see you guys in the next one. Peace out, everybody. Perfect.